Someone You Should Know. A program about people you know, and even more that you don't. Hosted by Stuart Sachs, veteran, husband, father, and grandfather. Now, here's your host, Stuart Sachs.
Well, welcome. Welcome. Glad to have you with us for another episode of Someone You Should Know. We are brought to you today by our good friends over at No Sweat Experts. Now, you know, we're getting ready to kind of transition between the winter season and the spring summer season. So now's a good time to reach out to No Sweat Experts here in Northern Texas and all to make sure that your air conditioning and heating air conditioning and heat is ready for the new changes of the seasons, getting the filters changed, checking all the coils and all that kind of good stuff. They know what they're doing. They know what they're talking about. They're good people. In Northern Texas, reach out to No Sweat Experts, good people. Well, today we're going to have actually two conversations. Believe that? Two for the price of one. Because we're going to have a serious conversation with a funny guy. And we're also going to have a funny conversation with a very serious guy. What am I talking about? I'm talking about Mike Knox, who is my guest for the show today. Mike, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. The audience probably doesn't know what the hell I'm talking about when I said a funny conversation with a serious guy and a serious conversation with a funny guy. But I know that you know what I'm talking about because the variety in your life, it amazes me because you do stand-up comedy, but you have some family issues that you have dealt with, and we're going to get into that. But you also spent a lot of your career in the prison system. So, I mean, from prison system to stand-up comedy to issues with your young daughter, that's about as much variety as one guy can get. So let's start with your career. How on earth did you get involved with serving as a prison guard?
So I was looking around for jobs. I talked to a friend, and my friend was in Arizona, and he said, yeah, it's really easy, which wasn't true. And then I was doing an internship in college, and they said, if you want to be a parole agent, you've got to work in a prison, which wasn't true either, because this was before the internet. So I didn't have I couldn't fact check anything. And I sent out a bunch of applications to different places. And of course, the prison, they just wanted you to have a heartbeat. So I got hired there, pretty quick. And then I went through that academy, and then I started getting offers from other places. And I was like, I don't want to go through another academy. And I wanted to write a book also. So there were different factors of why I did it. There's a lot of regrets to being there, but I think I definitely learned a lot about life at a very early age.
Now, you said that there was an interest in serving as a prison guard, and you said writing a book. Were you planning on writing a book about your experiences as a prison guard?
Yes. So I went in always writing notes, which nobody liked. They didn't like me writing stuff down. Everybody's very paranoid and suspicious about everybody. So I did go in with the intention of, yes, I want to write a book. And I just didn't realize in the beginning there's so many stories and information that you get out of the prison because it's its own world in its own.
You said to become a parole officer, what a prerequisite is to have served time as a prison guard.
Yes, but that wasn't really true. My internship was with probation. So probation and parole don't know what each other does. Jails and prison don't know what they do. So a lot of people get them confused. And so I was listening to what probation was telling me, which wasn't true. You didn't have to work in a prison, but I was just going off of the information that people would tell me, thinking that was credible information. I just realized later on, because one of the things that they told me was, you're in kind of like a recruiter had said, well, you have a college degree, so you'll never be on the ground around the inmates. You'll be in a tower away from everybody. And the very first day there was a guy with no teeth that was like, you're going to be on the ground for the next 20 years. And I was horrified because I'd totally been lied to. And then I was also told this is a minimum prison. And the day that I graduated, they changed it from a minimum prison to a maximum security prison. So again, that's prison. It's always ever changing. And it's just, You know, it's like 90%, 99% boredom and 1% terror.
Hey, Mike, it's something like serving in the military.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They tell you, you're going to get this desk job, and all of a sudden they stick a rifle in your hand and say, go out there and watch for bad guys. So tell us a little bit about the experience in working in the prison system. I found out something in talking to you earlier prison guards and parole officers and all are considered first responders. And I never knew that.
Yes. So I never knew that in the beginning either, but say that there's an escape from the prison, you're the first responder on that escape. There's all these vehicles and things that I never knew about. And we had escapes at the prison, and then the everybody from the prison is out there trying to search for these guys and trying to find them first, because they don't want to look like an idiot if local police departments get them. And then with parole, you're the first responder all the time because of the fact that you're in the community. You're watching over the parolees. You're in their homes. You know the parolee better than anybody else. And you're side by side with the police searching their homes. You're also, parole is warrantless searches. You don't need a warrant. You can go into any home. You can go into any sort of property. You don't need a warrant for anything. So that's huge for the police departments. They always use parole for that specific reason.
Again, all these years, I never realized that. And in that situation, when you are dealing with parolees, is there a specific number of years that you have to follow that parolee, or is that established by the court?
It's set for 3 years, and then you have a determination of whether or not you, if they're doing well, you recommend for them to get off within a year, which is one of the things that I hated about parole, was that you would have somebody that was doing great. You know, they have a job, they're staying out of trouble, they're doing everything they're supposed to be doing. And then your supervisors look at, well, there's just this commitment offense, and they retain them on parole for another 3 years. There's also very high control ones that are on for 5 years. And then there's other ones that are lifers. They're on for their entire life. They are kind of trying to do away with that and trying to lessen those punishments, because that was another thing I never really liked about parole also, was it's this idea that we're punishing them for the rest of their life. And I don't think that that's right.
And obviously, if they're on parole for 3 years, I mean, in the back of my mind, I'm saying, hey, all I got to do is be a model citizen for 3 years. Then if I get a good recommendation and say I can go off of parole, then maybe I can, you know, backslide and go back to some of my old talents.
Yeah, they're usually just doing those same talents in front of you. You have probably 90% of them that are just, they're just criminals. And that, but again, they were raised in institutions, they were raised in dysfunctional families. And so that's really never taken into account of, hey, this is somebody that's a product of their environment. And then you have the 10% that are from the gate, they get out and they found themselves a job, they've gotten themselves a place to live, you know, right away, this guy, he's not going to be any problem whatsoever. So it's this multitude of people, you know, that you're dealing with all the time. It's a juggling act.
Now, are you still in that career now?
No, thank goodness I retired a year ago. I just could not. It just got so bad with the political climate of you were powerless pretty much, because you would do your job to find someone and arrest them for a crime, and then the court would let them out, and then the court would blame parole, and parole would blame the court. It was just kicking the can down the road.
Vicious cycle.
Yes.
You know, so now are you basically now gonna concentrate on being an author?
Yeah, so I'm concentrating on writing, stand up, and acting. So all the things that I wanted to do that I didn't have time for. A lot of that I didn't have time to do because of the job, but also because my daughter was sick for a very long time. So life just got in the way, and now I'm doing things that I wanted to do.
Is it fair to say that a lot of your experiences in the prison system and all was good material for your stand-up routines?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just constantly, that's what got me through the prison. It's so dumbed down, and you become so dumbed down. And the only way that I got through it was with humor. I mean, it's constant fear all the time and violence. You know, it's concrete and steel. There's no kind of beauty into it. So you've got to find that beauty. And I do equate it to it is kind of like being in war. You just get used to it. I mean, you literally are falling asleep on the day room floor with 200 inmates, you know, convicted killers and rapists walking around you because you're just so used to it. And it just becomes so dysfunctional and it wears on your body.
Yeah, I guess I can understand why it's not really something that, you know, you say it's your normal routine, but you don't really want to spend your whole life with that kind of a normal routine. So you wrote a book and it's called Straight Fish, and it is about your time, in the prison system. And I'll explain the title. That's the first thing that I wanted to know.
Sure. I should have probably changed the title in my, earlier writing days. Straight fish means you're new. It's a write-up or an infraction for the inmates to curse at the prison guards or correctional officers. But if you say straight fish, it's kind of that, you know, gray line where it's acceptable, but it's also a put down. It's a derogatory remark to the, you're so new, you're so stupid, you're a straight fish. So the fish were the new, you're the new fish in the pond. Straight fish meant you knew absolutely nothing. And so a lot of times, you know, my very first day with, which everybody's first day is, they drop you in there and you're trying to search where to go and what equipment to get, and nobody wants to help you. And so you're just in like crisis mode for me, it was crisis mode for the first couple of years, because you're constantly hopping around in different positions and then nobody wants to help you. Everybody's very negative. You really do rely on the inmates are the ones telling you, oh yeah, you go get your equipment in building three. You want to post up over here, because the officers aren't going to help you do anything because you're the straight fish. You're the new guy that doesn't know anything. And the reality of that is that you're so new that you cause problems walking into places because you don't know what's going on. But then again, nobody's telling you what's going on.
Did you find yourself looking over your shoulder a lot?
Oh yeah, that's normal. They would say to you too, you know, that was the first couple of weeks. They would be like, are you scared? And I'd be like, yeah, to death. And they'd be like, that's normal. Because if you're not scared, then you're crazy. And we shouldn't have you here. So everybody was scared. And that's the reality also, is you're with convicted, you know, felons. They're still, you know, there's good guys there, but there's very horrible people there. And you would see fights and stabbings and you'd see people die. It just wasn't, you know, constant, but you did see it. And I saw somebody get beaten to death. I don't think anybody should see any of that, but that's the reality of prison. I think a lot can change to change the idea of violence inside the prison. And I think that they're kind of working on it. But when I was there, it certainly wasn't. It was just about punishment.
Yeah. I listened to one. You also do some podcasting on YouTube. And I listened to you. Actually, I think it's your most recent podcast when you were talking about a casino in a prison.
Yeah, that was in Nevada. And that blew my mind because I would love to have been there for the history part of it. But there's always gambling is huge in prisons. You know, sports is, everybody's watching TV because there's so much downtime and they don't have access to, most prisons, they don't have access to computers, or there's a lot of cell phones that are smuggled in. But when I was there, there was none of that. I think somebody found a beeper one time, but that was really, you know, it was very hard to communicate. And so things like gambling that's always going on. And you would see gambling constant because it's just, you know, you're doing your time and there's so much time to do.
I'm going to ask you a question because it's always been a curiosity of mine. And that is, in a lot of prison movies that I've seen over the years, and let's face it, a lot of movies are embellished, but very often they talk about a criminal that goes into prison and continues to run their drug business or their mafia business or whatever from inside the prison, just like if they were outside the prison walls. Is that a reality? Is there a lot of that crime that is being run from inside the bars?
Yeah. And the reason for that is, like, you can communicate by telephone and writing. And so it just takes longer. And I think it's hard for people to realize, you know, it's like when I was younger, you'd have to wait for that communication. And now everybody's so used to this instant communication. So they'll just send a letter, hey, have this package come in through this way. And so it might take a couple of weeks or months, but they'll still get those drugs or that contraband. And it comes in through visiting, or it comes in through the mail, or it comes in through staff. There's just the perception that it's always coming in through staff isn't true. But they have all the time in the world to orchestrate all this stuff. And it's really just slowing down your mind and going, hey, I can, you know, manipulate all these other people. You would hear it on the phones all the time. They would randomly call people on the phone and manipulate people to send them money. I mean, they have skills, and that always interested me, especially things that they made. Just making stuff out of nothing always interested me too. So I would collect all that stuff. All that contraband was just fascinating to me.
I mean, I figure for what they didn't know going into prison, they probably learned how to do in prison from other inmates, too, in order to communicate to their people on the outside. It must be a nerve-wracking business, because at the time you were married at the time that you were serving in the prison system too. And what effect did that have on your wife and your family?
It's horrible, because what I didn't know is there's a lot of nepotism. So there's a lot of people that are related in the prison system. They're married. They all know each other. They're divorced from each other. I didn't know anybody. And my wife didn't understand the prison, that you're locked down and stuck there. So there were a few times where, and then I couldn't call out to tell her. So like one particular time on New Year's Eve, I'm stuck there. All the inmates have boarded up in their cells, and I was there 20 hours. And I get home exhausted, and my wife is thinking that I'm out drinking, because I had no way to contact her at the time. And so you really do need to be on the same page as your spouse. But you will, that's the norm. You get stuck there in the prison and you can't leave, which was another thing I hated about it. You couldn't leave outside of that prison. You couldn't just walk out. They wouldn't let you out of a gate that's monitored by somebody. So you don't really have, you really do kind of feel like you're, there is that blurred line where you kind of feel a lot of times like the inmates themselves.
I was going to say you're a kind of a good guy that's locked up.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I think I can understand the feelings of your spouses back home, because when you take off, it's very, very similar to the wife or so of a police officer or a fireman. They leave to go to work, and you just don't know what the circumstances are going to be that given day, if they're going to be put into harm's way.
And then the other thing too is nobody understands. Like I couldn't go. I was missing so many. That was another reason why I wanted to get out of there so quickly, was a lot of people don't understand when you go to, like, you're going to functions, you're going to parties, whatever. They don't understand. You're talking about stuff that goes on in the prison, and they're just, well, that's not what I heard from watching TV. I don't believe you. I don't believe that would go on. Okay. And then, so you become very isolated yourself. That's why you see a lot of law enforcement that are very angry, very, kind of they're bottled up with their emotions, because you're not allowed to have any emotions. And if you convey your emotions to other people, then they lash out at you. So you just basically, everything just gets sucked up inside, and you just, I turned into that person, somebody that didn't want to talk to anybody because I thought nobody cared about me. And you become the product of prison as well. And I just was able to see I need to get out of there because of that reason. But there's other people that still stay there 30, 40 years, because it just becomes a cult. You just become so used to it that dysfunction becomes a reality to you.
So was comedy an escape for you?
Yeah, one of the big things for me was, especially writing, I could write stuff down, even though there are people, other officers that would be mad at me for writing down stuff, because they wanted you to be dumbed down. But I would write, you know, I was writing a TV script at the time, and that would just, okay, another day. This is funny. I can take that. I could write down these stories and kind of put them together and make humor out of it. And that would get me through the next day, the humor. Or talking, there was probably a good 10% of other people, that other staff that I could rely on. You know, in particular, there was one guy my very first day that had told me, you know, he had said, don't worry about it. This place is just so dysfunctional. I used to be a sheriff, and this is far worse. So there was at least somebody that would talk to you and be like, you're not as crazy as you think you are.
Welcome to my dysfunctional world. That's crazy. But were any of your other, you know, associates that you served in the prison also have this pension for using comedy as kind of an outlet?
Yeah, they're not necessarily doing stand up, but there was, you know, there was one guy in particular that I remember very well, where he had been in the Marine Corps and he had been in Afghanistan, and he had just said to me, "Yeah, it's completely screwed up, but you got to run towards the fire and deal with it." And one of the things that always resonated with me, he said, I was one of the few people in my platoon that when they wanted me to go travel outside of the base to like go get air conditioning supplies, I wanted to do it just to get rid of the monotony of it. So I would volunteer for stuff all the time. And he said, if you just know that it's screwed up and you know that it's dysfunctional and you know that you've accepted that, your mind is going to be able to deal with it a lot better. And that always stuck with me. And I kind of look like it, like that guy saved my life.
What was the prison population at the prison that you spent most of your time?
There's 5,000 inmates there, and how they divided up 4 yards and then a minimum yard. So you're supposed to, the cells are only supposed to hold 1,000 inmates, but they put 2 in there. And then when I was about to leave, they were putting 40 on the floor. So there was 240 in each housing unit. I mean, they just, to me, it was just so sad. Another thing that I hated also is it's an 8x10 box, concrete and steel. And you think somebody's mentally going to be okay after that? No, they're not. And so I was always a big proponent of, can we at least have, single cells or a bigger cell? And they've never done that. But I would watch, you would watch people go crazy.
Holy cow. The website is mikeknox.com. Folks, visit it. It has some interesting information, not only about Mike, but the one book, and we're going to start talking about the other book too, but the one book about straight fish. Interesting, got to be a really good read, because it's on a subject that most of us have really no clue about. But all of this time that you were now serving in the prison system, you were also dealing with a very, very serious issue in your family. And that was with your daughter. And that is the subject of another book that you wrote called Vivian's Reign. And I want you to explain to those that are watching and listening about your sweet daughter, Vivian, what her diagnosis, at what age, and how she's doing today.
Sure. So today she's doing great. She's 17. At the age of 2, she had a massive seizure at the age of 2 out of the blue. My wife found her in her crib and we rushed her to the hospital where she flatlined. She was, revived. So she really had a very near-death experience. And then the next 6 years was trying to figure out what it was, going back and forth to different doctors, different hospitals, different medications. We finally found a good doctor who finally recommended the vagus nerve stimulator, which is a VNS. It's like a pacemaker for your brain. So it's sending impulses to your brain from your vagus nerve. You have a vagus nerve that goes to your brain and you have another one that goes down to your stomach. And that's kept her seizure free for the last 7 years and basically saved her life. I mean, there was a time where she couldn't dress herself. She needed to always have constant supervision. She was like a little zombie. And probably about 6 months after getting that VNS, she woke my wife and I up and, said, "Hey, I made my lunch. I dressed myself. I'd really like to go to school." And that was a kid that never wanted to go to school. She was always afraid to go to school. So it was like this light bulb switched on and her brain was like off and running. And now she's a happy teenager, that gets straight A's. So to me, it was just like, I'm not allowed to say that any spiritual thing, but it was just like so amazing to see your child progress where we were told that she was never going to progress past the second grade, mentally or physically.
I don't want to pave over what you said earlier about a VNS. Because I'm sure that there's a lot of people watching and listening that don't know what that VNS is all about. Can you explain a little bit more about what it is and what it does to her body?
Yes, it's the vagus nerve stimulator. So it's an implant, and it's probably about the size of a silver dollar. And then there's leads that go to clamp onto your vagus nerve. So it's about a hour, 45 minute procedure at the hospital. And she was, we were in and out of there pretty quick. And she was back home dancing around the house, eating a happy meal. So it was pretty quick for recovery. And she, pretty much prior to the VNS, wasn't able to you know, she had brain fog, wasn't able to sleep. She wasn't able to communicate very well. So all the things we kind of take for granted, the VNS is sending electronic impulses and interrupting those seizures that had been distracting, you know, had been distracting her brain from functioning properly.
And now is this once it's implanted, end of story, or is this something that has to be monitored, re-implanted on any kind of a regular basis?
It'll last, the battery lasts about 8 years. And so last year, her battery was changed out. So this is her second battery. There is technology that they're trying to do to recharge it. So I'm looking forward to that. But it's been around 22 years, I want to say. It's been around a long time, probably more than that now. So it's proven technology. It's also can be linked, kind of like linked to an iPad. You can go to the doctor, or you can have, there's actually people through the company that will come and meet you halfway. And you can download all that information, which was great for me. I was always, the horrible thing about seizures is they come out of nowhere. You never know when they're happening. You can't predict them. So I was kind of always writing stuff down, trying to see, narrow down the, when I could predict them to happen. And what I noticed the pattern with her was they were definitely in her sleep or coming out of her sleep. It was affecting the right side of her body because she would have paralysis. She would be paralyzed, for quite some time after the seizure. And, just with the VNS, you know, all that stuff kind of went away.
And the VNS was first implanted at what age?
At the age of 8. And so there's a lot of good educational materials out there about how the earlier that you get it, the better it is. And the longer that it's going, the better it is. So I look at it like it's a bodyguard for your brain because it's constantly there. It's on 24 hours a day. And so she's most likely still having seizures, but they're just being stopped by the VNS. The other thing with the VNS is that you can carry a magnet. You can swipe the magnet across your chest if you feel a seizure coming on in an aura, and you can stop the seizure, which was great also because I could then give those to teachers, because prior to that, or teachers, friends, relatives, nobody wanted to carry rescue medication. Nobody wanted to learn how to do anything. There's a lot of, there's actually very little education. There's very little laws. So the schools don't have to be trained. So, you know, every day I'd take her to school, I'd have to watch her at school. If I had to go to work, my wife and I both worked, she might have one at school and the school wasn't required to do anything by law.
So if you have a daughter that has epilepsy and all, even the school nurse or school medical people, they're not aware of that or in order to be trained in order to do something in a case of an emergency?
Oh, they're aware. They just don't care. A lot of it just comes down to, unless there's a law, what I just learned going through the whole experience. Unless there's a law, they're not going to do anything about it. She would get bullied about her epilepsy. The school would do nothing. I would just have to ultimately change the school. Their recommendation was, well, why don't you just leave the school? So there, beyond the seizures, there were just so many problems that I had at school, at work, and it was just simply because there's no laws to protect anybody.
I'm curious, what was it like those, I guess, what, 6 years? You said she first had her first seizure at about age 2, but she didn't get the implant until age 8. So there was a 6-year period there where you and Nicole had to deal with her epilepsy more on a personal basis than within, you know, when she started school, and all. What were those years like? And I mean, it sounds like the VSN was like a breath of fresh air for you, because it gave you the respite and the comfort of knowing that there's something that's working for the benefit of your daughter.
Yeah. Those 6 years were basically just staying at home, not going, couldn't go anywhere, and relying on my wife and my wife relying on us. So thank goodness that we were a great team together. And it was, everything revolved around waiting for that next seizure and at least knowing it's probably going to be in her sleep. So we would take turns watching her all night long and catching the seizure and administering medication. Sometimes the seizure wouldn't stop. So we'd have to go to the hospital and get more medication. So it was living in crisis. It was just living day to day. It was very sad, but at the same time, that was all that we knew. And you know, I can remember going, I went to go pick up a medication one time and everybody was cheering because I think the Lakers had just won. I had no idea what was on TV or anything or what was going on in the world because I was so used to just waiting for seizures.
Everything revolved around your daughter.
Yeah, that and work. So you really don't have anything else. And then everybody alienates you because they just don't understand. So family and friends just stop calling you or coming over or checking on you. Nobody cares. And you really see the reality of everybody. But you can't really blame them for that. And then, you know, kind of for me, I was always looking for empathy and I was never getting empathy from anybody. And so you really are on your own. It's very lonely. And then waiting up all night long, it was just a lack of sleep. I mean, because my daughter would have a lot of insomnia. So she would kind of stay up for a day or two and then crash. So I would be sleeping in the car at work or at lunchtime or whatever, you know, kind of napping. But really, my wife and I weren't getting a good 8 hours of sleep. So that was a big thing that I noticed with VNS was we could all sleep for once. Our whole family could sleep. And we were for that whole time in between age 2 and 8, we weren't sleeping at all. And so it just affects all your everyday life, not being able to sleep.
Well, and a lot of this responsibility fell on your wife's shoulders because you were off at work and sometimes working long days and shifts and everything. It had to have played a pretty good mental role on you during that time also.
It did, but she was also working. We were both working because we live in Los Angeles. So,
yeah,
of course, you know, you're struggling to survive. So it was, and that we're, you know, I thankfully had my mother also was there when she could be. So there were people that would help us, but at the same time, there was a lot of people that wouldn't help us. You know, insurance would drop us or the pharmacy wouldn't carry your medication. It just seemed to me like it was just always desperation. And I see that with other, you know, when you reach out to these support groups for epilepsy and they don't want to help you because they're about fundraising, you really just feel like lost. You know, I was reaching out to all these places, you know, I'd never heard of epilepsy. I didn't know anything. I think the only thing that I saw about a seizure was on a Different Stroke episodes with Gary Coleman. That was it. So I never really knew anything about it, and getting into it, as far that I did, I really realized like how underfunded it is. And I mean, epilepsy seizures kill more people than breast cancer does. It's just that epilepsy organizations, because there's no cure, there's no end result to it. They really don't.
They're treating the symptoms and not the disease.
They don't really think they need to fund it as well as they should. But there's 65 million people with epilepsy in the world, and 1 in 3 people are going to have a seizure within their lifetime. You know, I mean, and it would surprise me also going to. You know, we were always going to the same hospital near us, and then it'd usually be early in the mornings, you know, like 3 or 4. So it'd be shift change. They didn't want you there, but then they would also act like they didn't know what seizures were. Oh, your kid's just drunk. My kid's 4, you know, so he's not drunk. So you're just constantly arguing with people, or I'd argue with the paramedics that showed up because they would say, you're not a doctor. Why would you give your kid medication? Because the doctor gave me this medication. So you're just like constantly dealing with people, it felt like you're constantly trying to stick up for yourself.
So you said Vivian is now 17 years old.
Yes.
So what, she's going to be graduating high school pretty soon?
She's a sophomore because of her seizures, she stayed back in the fifth grade because she was in the hospital for so long.
What is her long range dreams?
Her long range dreams she wants to go to college and she wants to do set design. That's her big thing. So she does, she likes to do YouTube videos. So she writes her own videos and directs them and wants to do set design.
Is she publishing or producing your podcasts?
So, you know what she does do is she edits my my acting auditions. So I always go to her, or if I need her to read my lines with me, she's my sidekick for that. So she helps me a lot.
Excellent, excellent. So now for Mike Knox, tell me a little bit more about your stand-up life. You know, is it mostly in small places around town, or are you looking into doing things? Some more things professionally on the stage and in you said in movies too?
Yeah, I'm usually just LA just because of the fact that I'm still Vivian doesn't drive. So I still take her to school every day. And I'm still, you know, it's not 100% great. There's still good days and bad days, just far better than before. So I still, until she is independent on her own, then I'll be able to travel with comedy, because that's really where comedy is, at least for making money, is you have to travel. So I'm just pretty much local there. But acting is great because of the fact that I can do auditions. I can send in a self-tape online.
It's interesting. A lot of this is interesting, and especially personally for me, because I have a niece that has epilepsy, and she was diagnosed as a juvenile epileptic, and she's dealing with she has a port if she needs the medication and all, she can self-inject and all. She's not only epileptic, but also has diabetes, juvenile diabetes. And, you know, you always think, you know, how would I handle it if that happened in my family? And then all of a sudden you are thrust into that role, being a dad who's got a career and my wife has got a career and we're dealing with that. And we've got this child who is fighting these diseases. You know, it can turn your life upside down.
Yeah. What's funny too, is we just moved in less than a year. We just moved into our new house and I'm married. I've got my daughter. And I remember a few days before her big seizure was thinking, you know, hey, this life thing's pretty easy. You know, and it was just like such a curveball of, you know, here you go. You get to deal with all this stuff. Looking back on it, it's just, it's horrible, and I wouldn't put it on anybody else, but it has made me so much humbler and appreciate my family. And I really do believe that in life, that what is the most important thing is your family. I know that there's crazy families out there, but my wife and my kid are that's my life. And I'm so grateful for that.
So when you're not working on now your acting career and your stand-up career and everything, when you can sneak away from the rest of life, what does Mike Knox like to do?
I'm a pretty boring person. I like to write. So I have, I've just got a place. Actually, whenever I need to be away there, I have a shed in the backyard and that's where I go and write. And I have tons of stuff to write, and that's where I'm the happiest to be. I know it sounds boring, but.
So sometimes a husband is sent out to the shed for other reasons. You go out voluntarily in order to create.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I love it.
Well, again, folks, MikeKnox.com. On the website, and oh, there's a nice little link. I encourage you, if this sounds interesting, the two books, Vivian's Reign and also Straight Fish, are available on Amazon. And you can read a little bit about what the books are all about. It's very, very interesting. What just popped up on the screen there too about epilepsy. You also are working within the legal system to try and get some laws to help epileptics. Am I correct?
Yes, I was previously working on a bill in California. Where teachers and school staff have to be trained to identify seizures. And I think that's the key, is once the school has to recognize that they have to take action, you're going to have a lot more happier families. And then the next bill that I want to work on is about, there's a lot of fake seizure videos on YouTube, TikTok, people monetize them. They make money having fake seizures. And that's where the bullying took place at my daughter's schools, was that everybody has a cell phone now. So they're seeing these fake seizure videos. They're thinking that if they're being told it's okay, you can make fun of people for it. And I see this online all the time, people making fun of seizures and epilepsy because they're told it's okay. So we need education that tells them that it's not okay to do that. And that needs to stop. And I think that only happens with law.
And also on your website is a little link where you can go into your podcasts, and you've done several podcasts. You have a great demeanor when you do your podcasts in talking, giving a little bit of history. The most recent one, another thing that I found fascinating was you were a Jonathan Winters fan, and you talked a little bit at length about his upbringing and his history and all, and the way you tell your stories and all is very, very comforting and You have a good voice for it and a good talent for it. I commend you for that.
Ah, oh, thank you. I did. I used to see Jonathan Winter when I lived in Santa Barbara all the time, and I miss that guy. But on the podcast, which I should do more, but I don't, I just try to highlight comedians because I have, and I definitely love to, I also like to, on my TikTok and Instagram, I like to go grave hunting and see famous graves. And it just, to me, it's very peaceful to actually go meet these celebrities, even though they're deceased. It might sound morbid, but especially a comedian, you know, you can go see, I could go meet Rodney Dangerfield. And then to be able to research their background and their history, to me, is fascinating. The history of where everybody comes from is so fascinating. You always see somebody that have they've just struggled to get there, and everybody has.
Well, and I think within the world of comedy, there's an awful lot of comedians and all when off camera struggle through life. John Belushi struggled through life. I'm trying to think some of the SNL talent and all had tough lives off camera, and as soon as they'd walk out on that stage, it was like a completely different persona.
Oh yeah, comedy is all about, to me, it's all about therapy. You're up there, and that is what makes that struggle. You know, it's your vulnerabilities. So when I go up on stage, I'm not making fun of epilepsy. I'm telling you the harsh reality of what I've had to deal with, or prison, you know, prison. Well, who wants to talk about prison? But there's a lot of funny stuff that happened in prison. And it's,
especially when there's a guard walking around with a little notebook and taking notes all the time.
Yeah. It's all material. Yeah. That's which I right. still do. I walk around writing stuff down all the time. I think, you know, my wife hates it, but there's always opportunity for more material.
Hey, you're writing down notes. Everybody else is on their cell phones with their thumbs and texting each other. So you're doing something, you know, positive.
Yeah, I got scolded the other day for writing down. They were like, you should have just taken a picture. I'm still writing stuff down.
Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to have this conversation with me. I think it's you've already led a few very, very fascinating lives. And all, and I don't doubt that there's a lot of great things coming up in the future of Mike Knox, and also for your sweet daughter Vivian. The very, very best to you and Nicole and Vivian in the future. And I'm going to keep dropping in and checking out some of your podcasts and everything, because I enjoy a lot of the information that you share with your audiences.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, that'll do it for another edition of Someone You Should Know. I end my show by saying, be yourself, because everyone else is already taken. And it's a good quote, and Mike's nodding his head, so I think he knows what I'm talking about. So go out, make it a great day. And again, thank you very, very much to my very special guest, Mike Knox.
Thank you.
Someone you should know.